underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. With his breakout debut novel, Rules of Civility, Amor Towles established himself as a master of absorbing sophisticated fiction, bringing late 1930s Manhattan to life with splendid atmosphere and a command of style. So after 2 decades of working for an investment firm, he left that profession to write full-time. His latest, A Gentleman in Moscow, is the story of a Russian aristocrat who is sentenced by the Bolsheviks during the revolution to a lifetime of house arrest in Moscow's Metropole Hotel. Unexpectedly, his reduced circumstances provide him a doorway into a much larger world of emotional discovery. It is a great pleasure to welcome Amor Towles to this week's Book Show. Thank you very much for being with us. A delight to have you on the program.
Thank you for having me, Joe.
What brought you to this particular subject, this idea of a man being under house arrest in a hotel?
Quite simply, I used to travel a good deal as an investment professional. I would spend a week in a hotel annually in London, in Los Angeles, in Chicago. And one year I was arriving at my hotel in Geneva, and for the 8th time, and I recognized some of the people in the lobby. And I thought to myself, you know, this is a pretty nice hotel, but you know, can you imagine if you had to live in it? You know, these guys look like they've been living here. And as I was taking the elevator upstairs, I sort of thought, oh, you know, actually, that's kind of an interesting idea for a story. And when I got to my room, I took out a piece of paper, and right off the bat, I felt if you're going to write a story about somebody trapped in a hotel, it should be by force. And, why, you know, Russia seemed like the perfect spot where house arrest has existed since the time of the Tsars in one form or another. But, you know, that was sort of the seed of the story. I had been to Moscow in 1998. And I had passed through the Metropole Hotel, which is in fact a grand hotel from around 1900, which is right around the corner from the Kremlin. And that was seemed like a perfect spot to entrap my count and ultimately you, the reader.
Tell us a little bit about this man, Count Alexander Rostov, and what it is about him that gets him there in that hotel. And I think the thing that is so fascinating about this is that he is in this luxury for 3 decades. This is a long-term sentence.
Yeah, indefinite in essence. It is the sort of the opening premise, as it were, is delivered in the form of a transcript right before the main body of the novel begins. And in that transcript, the count, who is 30 years old, a Russian count, is being interviewed by a Bolshevik tribunal in 1922. And in the course of that brief exchange, it's clear that the count has, because he wrote a poem that was very popular with the revolutionary generation as a younger man, he's got friends that are high up in the party apparatus. He's also clearly an unrepentant aristocrat. So the tribunal determines sort of the best solution of dealing with this person who's got friends but yet poses sort of a threat to society as an unrepentant aristocrat is they tell him that he can go back to the Metropole where he has been living already, and if he ever comes out of the hotel again, he'll be shot. And the novel then opens with him being marched out of the Kremlin across Red Square and through the doors of the hotel where, as you say, he spends the next 32 years. It is sort of a sentencing of really just because he's an aristocrat. And of course, historically speaking, there was a good deal of that in the aftermath of the revolution. Not all Russian aristocrats left the country, nor were all imprisoned or sentenced to some form of house arrest. Many stayed and did their best to sort of muddle through the communist era. But yes, he is trapped in the hotel as a sort of an official order.
I want to get into the history and Russian history in a moment, but this is also very much a psychological novel in the sense that what you do when you are alone in a room by yourself and what happens around you.
That's right, Joe. And I appreciate you pointing that out because the aspects of Russian history are kind of a backdrop. They're almost in the distance in the novel. It really is about this individual who's grappling with being in an isolated situation. And the count has to bring to that situation a variety of resources to kind of get through. And he certainly benefits from the fact that he's generally an optimistic figure. He's someone who is inclined to see the best in other people. This ends up being a big advantage when you're trapped in a hotel. It makes it easier for you to find interest in other people, make friends, you know, socialize, as it were. But he was also raised in kind of a 19th century home, a noble home, where he was taught as a young person, you know, part of being a proud individual, a proud gentleman, is that you wouldn't show signs of defeat. You stay upright, you stay proud, and that becomes something that he can lean on as well as he sort of goes through this process of being trapped in the hotel. Early in the story, he ends up getting a lucky break in that a young girl, 9-year-old girl, who is kind of fascinated by him because she's heard that he's a count, and she's the daughter of a Bolshevik who's kind of trapped in the hotel in her own way. She approaches him, and they kind of become friends. And she opens the door for him in sort of the early stages of his malaise to kind of rediscover what the hotel could be for him. Because, you know, I think the way I look at it is children don't really understand claustrophobia. You know, that's sort of an adult malady. This young girl, I think like any young kid, loves the hotel. You know, she's investigating every corner of it and bringing her imagination to it, her curiosity to it. And that kind of begins the process of the count sort of thinking about this nice prison he's in a much more generous way, and begins the process of him kind of exploring the hotel and the people in it in order, in essence, to discover life.
In that discovery, because that does come, but for you as a writer, was there a concern initially that you were going to, in essence, trap your protagonist and even you as a writer and us as readers into this room, and that could be a challenge that you would have to overcome?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's no question that I know that if I'm going to walk up to somebody and they, you know, say, here's this 450-page book I've just written, and in it the main character goes into a hotel on the third page and he doesn't come out again, you know, for 30 years, that's a daunting proposition. You know, I wouldn't welcome that as a pitch. So it is a challenge. I have to find within the hotel, just like the count has to, I have to find the charisma of life, the emotional connections. I have to mine memories. I have to rethink who I am. You know, having been, in the case of the count, someone who's trained in culture and has never had a job and has had, you know, a very refined life, that there's an opportunity for him to rediscover sort of the simpler aspects of life and connections that can come through that, like through work or through acquaintanceships and friendships and your responsibility to others. So yes, there's kind of this discovery process that takes place for him, and that is, as you say, it's an artistic challenge that's parallel to that, because I have to bring for the reader all of the chemistry associated with the development of those relationships and kind of the magical sort of aspect of sort of the hotel suddenly beginning to feel like an infinite space as the count rediscovers life and purpose and relationships, and in order to keep the reader's interest. Many authors, I think, choose to constrain their story in physical space because that challenge can be very productive. It almost fires the imagination a little bit, and it forces the artist to be a little sharper in the way that you draw chemistry out of descriptions or conversations or your thought process. And, you know, Moby Dick being an extreme example. Right in the first pages, Melville has marched Ishmael and us onto a boat, and there's no getting off that boat. And, you know, that's a pretty close quarters. Yet Melville uses that. He's confined in that space with us, with Ishmael. And what he does is he brings the whole world into the boat.
And we get to see the count's transformation of him understanding and rediscovering life and so much about the memories that are still there before the time he walked through the doors of that hotel.
That's right. In Gulag Archipelago, Solzhenitsyn's, you know, really harrowing and amazing book about his life, mm-hmm. in the prison system of Russia in the much later, in the 1940s and early 50s. One of the things that he says about that experience is, and he almost says it as advice, should you be arrested, in essence. You know, you're about to go off in this incredibly harrowing environment, you know, a hostile environment, hard work, no comforts, extreme anonymity, you know, no connection to family. That's what your future holds to some degree. His advice to the prisoner is immediately start getting to know the people around you. Start building memories and drawing on your memories, because you never know, you know, he says, you know, when the memory of this conversation or of this person will be what, in essence, gets you through the night. And that, of course, is what the Gulag Archipelago as a work of literature came out of the fact that he did that. He interviewed everybody he met and you know, built a bigger and bigger and bigger inventory of stories of these human beings that he shared this you know, rough experience with. So the account has it's not obviously quite as harrowing as that by any means, but the exploration of memory is the first thing he does. You know, when he's trapped in the hotel, it's almost like Proustian. He can go back and revisit his thoughts of his childhood, of his sister who has gone, his grandmother who was a terrific character, his godfather who was a terrific character. And these memories of his childhood home in the country, they sustain him. But then slowly what happens is as he begins to connect to the people in the hotel, the life around him, the daily life, his immediate life, in a way kind of rolls over his memories and they sort of start to merge. But yes, initially it is the memories that sustain him and give him a sense, help him maintain a sense of who he is in a world that has uprooted his entire past.
Amor Towles is the author of the new book, A Gentleman in Moscow. It is published by Viking. I am someone who loves to live in a book, and when I'm reading, I love to go back and reread passages, and if I read something that I don't quite remember, to go back and to find it. Your novel is filled with that. There are so many small little things, minor events, and little objects that are mentioned in the first half of the novel that all start to converge and very much come to life in the second part, which is really interesting and fascinating. How much of that is a challenge? Even the idea of how much of a hint do you give so that readers are connected to that later on in the novel?
I think that's the biggest challenge that I faced in writing the book. And so to elaborate on your observation, I think of the narrative structure of this particular book as being a diamond on its side. You know, you start with him, the Count, being marched into the hotel. It's kind of the point of the diamond on the left. And experience starts to open up for him. But we as readers, I'm the author, you the reader. What happens in the course of the first couple hundred pages is a slowly widening out of information. You know, there are, as you say, there's objects with memories associated with them. There's people that you learn about. There's objects within the hotel. There are rooms in the hotel that you learn about. There are events from the past that you learn about. It's this accumulation of sharp details. It's not clear what the role they all play necessarily. Now, in the back half of the novel, it's the other side of the diamond. All of these elements start to come together into a very sharp point. And so the challenge, as I say, artistically, is I've got to keep your attention during that first 200 pages as this information is being sort of carefully relayed. I can't let you feel like it's just a clutter of stuff with no purpose, because you would rightfully shut the book and move on. So all of those little elements have to kind of be woven into the narrative in such a way that they feel like the exact thing that you would want to read about at that moment. And however unclear their longer term significance, that you have to feel like I'm glad I learned that little element, that little anecdote, or I'm glad we've studied this object on the table so closely. So it has to earn its place, in essence, in the first half, and that, as you say, it's kind of a sort of requires a lot of meticulous work in the editing process, where you're refining each of those little elements and making sure that they can hold their own in that first half before their ultimate purpose is fully recognized.
I love that idea of you thinking of it as a diamond on its side. When did that dawn on you? At what point did you say, oh, that's a good analogy for what I'm doing here?
When I was finished, basically, to tell you the truth, it was. I would love to tell you that on the first day of the outline, there's a little diamond drawn on my page. You know, that's what it'll be. You know, no, it was not like that. And I think that I certainly knew that there were going to be events that were culminating as I got. I outlined very carefully as a writer, so I knew what was going to happen. But the degree to which various elements would it would be downplayed in the first half and become significant in the second half, that kind of grew in force as I was going through the book, and it was clear that these other elements were going to resurface and be, you know, tied together and drive events and perspectives. So it was kind of an after-the-fact discovery, having said that, the best way to put it is I was trained to some degree as a younger writer by Peter Matheson. I spent time studying writing with him at college, and you know, became quite close to Peter, who's you know, obviously a very accomplished both writer of fiction and nonfiction.
Right.
You know, sadly passed away just a few years ago. But you know, Peter told me early on that in the way he thought about his own work in novels is that it was so important for him to kind of have he would call it, you know, the wire that runs through the book. And he really wanted to know where that was going and that was kind of pulling him through the narrative and pulling the reader through ultimately too. And I mean, and I understand that I kind of always thought of that similar idea. I know there's writers who kind of, for them, the starting process of a work of fiction is, you know, it's the beginning of the book. It's the idea or an event occurs or a premise or, you know, a terrific image. And they start laying out the book and it gets, you know, it opens wider and wider and wider. And some other writers who use that, you know, as the driving force, they don't always necessarily get – sometimes the back quarter of the book can be quite disappointing because you get that sense that they created the book out of this wonderful energy of the starting point, you know, almost like a big bang. But like a big bang, it just sort of went out all in all kinds of different directions. And that's not – that may not be the best outcome for that particular novel or for the reader. So I even though I like beginnings, I'm very focused on where is this thing going? You know, a little bit of a version of what Peter said. And, you know, I want to know right from the start, you know, where am I headed with this? Where are we going? Because it's a helpful organizing principle for me in terms of managing the importance of information, the momentum, the pacing of the book, and to keep me driving forward. So in a way, the diamond is a version of that. Even though I wasn't really thinking of the diamond in the case, and that's, you know, clearly what this book is structured like. But I did have the narrowing sense at the end, clearly in my mind, and because that's a helpful way for me to move through the book.
I assume the answer, and very well could be to this question, both. But it seems that when we talk about the Russian history, you obviously have an interest in that, but it seems to be almost greater in Russian literature.
Sure. I mean, and my fascination with Russia begins with literature, without a doubt. I'm not a historian. I don't speak Russian, but I am a great fan of the golden age of Russian literature, you know, the great 19th century writers from Russia, you know, many of whom were basically writing simultaneously. It's really quite an incredible era of creative productivity in narrative coming out of Russia, because you've got Tolstoy and Dostoevsky and Chekhov and Turgenev, you know, all overlapping in a relatively short period of time, and I'm fans of all of their work. So yes, that my interest in Russia begins there, and over time I grew to more interested in the history of the country, and so that plays a role too in this book, but it's not the dominant force.
In not being a dominant force, how do you get ready for something like this to say, okay, this is the place where I want it to be, and this is what I want to be the context of a novel that is limited in its movement?
I'm going to flip that around a little bit, Joe, in that I'm very wary about applied research in narrative writing. I think we've all read books where it's clear that the author has done terrific applied research, but that's what it feels like when you're reading the novel. You know, there's, you know, brand names or historical events or dates that sort of get clunked down, you know, in the narrative, proving that this is taking place in such a time, it's, you know, such a date, and that the author has familiarity with that era. You know, and sometimes that can be a terrific accomplishment. But often it's at the expense of the more traditional heart of narrative writing, of novels. I mean, it can come at the expense of our immediate connection to the characters, to their emotional experience, to the nuances of their relationships, to the underlying themes of their lives and how they interact. And which is, as I say, that's the heart of the novel for me. And you don't want to create obstacles between the reader and that experience. So with sort of this, in essence, can become a clutter of sort of timely little tidbits. So I am wary about that kind of research. What I try to do, therefore, as I say at the beginning, I was going to turn this around a little bit, which is I try to write from an area of fascination to begin with. You know, I was fascinated with New York in the early 20s and 30s already, long before I started Rules of Civility. which is, you know, set in 1938 in New York, I'd watched the movies, I'd listened to the music, I'd read the novels. You know, I knew something of the popular figures, and I digested all that. It was in the fiber of my thought process before I started that book. And at the end of that book, I went back and kind of fact-checked to make sure the Queensboro Bridge existed, you know, 1938, you know, that kind of thing. And this project is similar in that way. I had enough love of Russian literature and also 20th century Russian art and, you know, the experiences under the Soviet era. Those were all fascinations for me long before I started this book, such that I could begin designing the book and really writing it, inventing it without doing research. Now, you know, as the process, you know, was moving towards conclusion, I spent a little bit more time going back and, for instance, studying those who had visited the Metropole Hotel in the course of the 20th century, sort of fascinated by what did they see? You know, how did they describe the lobby? How did they describe events in the 20s or the 30s or the 40s in this hotel? And that became a fun way to kind of, towards the end of the invention process, to bring in some historical elements. And there are certain, you know, the purges are in the book to some degree. The show trials are in the book to some degree. The famine is in the book to some degree. These major events that occurred in Russian history between 1920 and 1950, the Stalinist era in which the book is set, you know, you can't ignore them, as an author, I shouldn't ignore them. They are a part of Russian life. So they have to be woven into. But again, I try to bring them in the spirit of sort of the individual who's walking through the life and observing things and picking them up and having relationships. They are a part of the human being's experience of living in Moscow at that time, but they're not necessarily the dominant, you know, thing on their mind every single day. And so it's kind of designed in that spirit.
There is such empathy and warmth, and it's so entertaining in reading the novel. We talked about challenges, and as my final question to you, were you ever worried that you made this house arrest perhaps just a little too charming?
Yeah, that would be one of the flaws of the book, I suppose. You know, you could point to that. I think there will certainly be some readers who find that frustrating. You know, readers who are very focused on the crimes that took place in the 20th century in Russia, you know, in essence, they're going to be like, you know, this is an outrage. You know, this book kind of skates past that. But I think that, and I don't think the book does skate past that, by the way. But I remember the fact that it's sort of an odd parallel, but Emily Dickinson's poetry, a significant portion of it, Walden by Thoreau, Moby Dick by Melville, the Hudson River School paintings, those beautiful paintings of the Hudson River Valley, these were all done during the era of slavery in the United States. Mm. So they're all pre-Civil War. Now, we don't go back and read those books and say, you know, where is the moral outrage? You know, why isn't, you know, slavery the center of these works? Because, you know, if you're in that time frame, you know, art is being created that addresses many different aspects of life. You know, while that great crime against humanity is taking place right in your backyard, and those people are great patriots. All those, you know, those authors are maybe a little less so Dickinson, but really all of them are singing. You know, Whitman is the other one, right? Whitman, of course, is there too. You know, they're all singing the great spirit of America with great optimism and you know, sense of purpose and, you know, beauty and, you know, the beauty of the country before them and the terrificness of the variety of the people. That's all in their books, you know, and it's happening while slavery takes place. So this book is a balance. One of the interesting things about Americans' view of Russia during the Stalinist era is that it's unbelievably narrow. It's unrealistically narrow. We have learned that the Stalinist era is defined by the famines, by the purges, by the show trials, by political oppression, by artistic oppression. And all those things did exist during that era, but they did not define the era for the average Russian from end to end. Russians continue to fall in love, to get married, to have children, to raise their children, to celebrate anniversaries with their family, to find a sense of purpose. There's a will to joy in, you know, the human species. And that was pursued by the Russians just as it was by, you know, the Americans in New England, you know, in the time of the Civil War. And this book is to some degree a tribute to that. It is trying to respectfully acknowledge the challenges of the time, yet also show that during that period like that, the people do continue to persist as best they can and find the connections they can that give their lives purpose and joy.
I greatly enjoyed the charm of the novel because it so sets up and allows the character that psychological discovery.
Yeah, thank you.
The name of the new book is A Gentleman in Moscow. It is published by Viking. Amor Toll, it's a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Joe. I appreciate it.
Again, the name of the new book is A Gentleman in Moscow. It's published by Viking. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.